May it please the court, my name is Mark Evans, number 40156. I'm here today on behalf of Mr. John Reinhold, and I would appreciate 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Jaguar Group was handling over 1,000 loans in multiple states. From that sizable body of business, the state found 16 properties which had fraudulent acts associated with them and decided to try Mr. Reinhold for those acts alone. Mr. Reinhold was able to prepare a defense for the acts associated with those 16 properties. He came to court with evidence that fraudulent documents had not been prepared by him, that he lacked culpable knowledge of wrongdoing, and that the real culprit was the woman who stole thousands of dollars for Jaguar before striking a plea. But rather than try Mr. Reinhold for the charges associated with those 16 properties, the state admitted evidence of non-specified wrongdoing associated with 40 additional properties held by Colorado State Bank and Trust, 14 or 15 by Citywide, and 28 by First Tier.
Well, counsel, but the substance of that testimony was very fleeting, wasn't it? It was simply there were 40 suspicious properties, and your client's name wasn't mentioned in connection with any of those, was he?
Your Honor, what we see in Spoto and in Usum is that when a defendant testifies and provides a plausible explanation of events to the jury, then credibility becomes a key issue in the case.
Excuse me, counsel, is that a yes or a no?
Well, Your Honor, it's a no. It's absolutely a no, and I'm trying to explain why.
Yeah, well, I'm asking about what the testimony was. It appears to me from the record the testimony was simply this bank had 40 some odd suspicious loans, this other bank had X number of suspicious loans, and the third bank had X number of suspicious loans, and that was it.
Your Honor, and then that's correct from Agent Nielsen. And then the representative from Colorado State Bank and Trust twice confirmed that 40 number, once in direct testimony and then once on, I believe it was redirect examination. And then the representative from Citywide also alluded to a pattern of misconduct. And I think that looking at that evidence, it's also important to note that when you get to closing argument, the prosecutor here devoted very little attention to talking about the specific charged offenses, and instead very frequently talked in general terms such as comprehensive schemes and shell games and juggling acts that cost banks millions of dollars, all of which implies that there is a very large number of bad acts here.
Counsel, even if the trial court should have excluded that information, even if the trial court erred in allowing it to come in, where was the prejudice, especially given that the bank representative ended up saying that, you know, most of the loans performed as they were supposed to?
Your Honor, the representatives from the banks testified that some of the loans were performing as they were supposed to, and that's undisputed. And they also testified, Colorado State Bank and Trust testified, that 40 loans were not, that those were highly suspicious loans on their books. And that, I mean, that's not just talking about a few extra acts here. Mr. Reinhold was charged with 16 properties, and just the information from Colorado State Bank and Trust alone implies that the magnitude of his wrongdoing is twice what was charged. And if you look at the entire 80 acts that were referenced by Agent Nielsen, that's four times what was charged. So I don't think that that can, you know, in a case where Mr. Reinhold stood up and presented evidence to the jury and said, listen, when you follow the money here, this wasn't me. When that credibility becomes an issue, to suddenly have the admission of evidence that what was going on here was at least four times larger than what was charged, I don't think that can be discounted.
Well, counsel, it seems to me there's the opposite inference here. You've got, if you investigate 40 suspicious loans and then you only charge five of them, isn't the inference that the other 35 checked out?
Your Honor, I believe that's incorrect, especially looking at the testimony from Colorado State Bank and Trust. I believe that when you go through that testimony, what they said is that we initially started looking at all 90 some odd loans on our books, and that of those, 40 were suspicious.
But it didn't go anything beyond suspicion. There's no testimony that goes anything beyond suspicion as to those that were not charged.
But Agent Nielsen's testimony was that the 16 properties charged were representative of the overall events here. So I think that that absolutely indicates that the 80 properties he referenced were also, they didn't check out, they were criminally culpable. And his testimony is that, you know, they found approximately 80 properties and then they sort of whittled them down to which ones were most representative of the, you know, schemes that they were charging, and then just charged those 16 acts. But by nature of being representative, the other 80 were bad as well. The district court here did not even attempt to perform the analysis required by Garner and Spoto for admitting evidence of other bad acts, and by not performing that analysis, abused its discretion. My hope here today is to illustrate that the record cannot independently support the admission of that evidence. Under Garner, the state's initial burden in admitting the evidence was showing by a preponderance of the evidence that it was Mr. Reinhold who committed these bad acts. And here, neither the prosecutor nor Agent Nielsen made any effort whatsoever to tie the multiple problematic loans at CSBT, Citywide, and First Tier to Mr. Reinhold. They produced no evidence, much less a preponderance, that the bad acts associated with the loans were committed by my client.
So, given that, how could it be prejudicial? There was just no testimony connecting your client to those loans.
The implication was certainly there for the jury, Your Honor. I mean, what that evidence did was to say Jaguar, and by implication, Mr. Reinhold, has committed approximately four times the wrongdoing that you're going to see here today. And you're right. I mean, the testimony did not establish that it was indeed committed by him, but that was certainly the implication provided by the prosecutor. And I mean, the question of admissibility, I mean, it's the state's burden to show to the district court before trial that this relates back to my client, and that showing was never made. I don't think it makes any difference one way or the other that showing wasn't made for the jury. And because the evidence wasn't there relating these other acts specifically back to my client, it also doesn't pass the four-part Spoto analysis. And as the materiality prong, that information did nothing more than illustrate that Jaguar Group as an entity had committed additional wrongdoing. The fact that Jaguar had committed wrongdoing was never disputed at trial. So evidence proving that fact was not material. The absence of materiality, the evidence was also not relevant to a material fact. Additional wrongdoing by Jaguar did nothing to show that Mr. Reinhold had any involvement or knowledge of this wrongdoing, so it didn't make a disputed issue more or less probable. The only relevance that this information could have had was to suggest that because Jaguar had committed bad acts in the past, therefore Mr. Reinhold must have done the charged bad things in this case. But in the absence of a precise evidentiary hypothesis which the state was required but failed to provide, that amounts to nothing more than the type of character propensity evidence forbidden by CRE 404B.
Well, counsel, it doesn't seem clear to me that the trial counsel for the defendant in this case actually made a 404B objection, which would have alerted the prosecution that it needed to present this hypothesis that you're talking about. I know that the 404B wasn't mentioned in any of the discussions about this particular issue. There was a general relevance objection, and that seems to be about it.
Your Honor, I'm going back to the hearing on January 7th, which is 4 days before this evidence was admitted. I think that we should try him on the counts that he's charged with and not on something else. I don't think that it's res justa. I think it's clearly additional bad acts. If you're talking about a much larger bad act than appears in these counts, then the jury goes, well, you know, we didn't hear all the evidence, I'm sure he must have done something wrong. If that, and I also think it's important to note that the prosecutor here clearly understood that we were talking about CRE 404B because the prosecutor said we didn't file another transaction motion in response to this. So, Your Honor, you're right. I mean, he did not say 404B, but if that rule is not clearly implicated by the statements I just read, then I don't know what does implicate it.
What about the case law that we have that says an investigator can testify about these kinds of things to explain the course of its investigation and how it started at one place and then got to another place?
Well, Your Honor, that's not what happened here. I mean, this information through Agent Nielsen came in at the very end of direct examination when he had already explained how he became involved in this case and the course that the investigation took. The prosecutor here was not asking about his investigation. He was asking about the result. The question was, how many suspicious properties did you find? So this information was not admitted, nor was it necessary to admit it in order to explain the course of the investigation.
You have about 4.5 minutes left if you want to save it, or you can continue. That's up to you.
Does the court have any questions at the moment? I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ethan Zwei, registration number 44794, and I'm here today on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. I plan on addressing both the evidentiary issues and the issue concerning subsection 4 of the COCA statute. First, all of the evidence in this case was admissible under simple relevancy and res geste principles. The evidence was relevant because it made it more probable that Mr. Reinhold committed both the COCA violations and the underlying predicate crimes.
Well, that seems to be a key point. How is it that testimony that only goes as far as saying there were 40 suspicious loans, other suspicious loans, or 40 total suspicious loans, how is that really relevant to the COCA claim? There's no specifics. There's nothing tying the defendant, who's the only one on trial, to those particular loans. It's just a general reference. It's kind of a, as counsel says, it's almost like a general reference intended to simply create the appearance that, oh, there's just this whole lot of wrongdoing going on. We're not going to get into it, but jury, just keep that in the back of your mind.
Sure. The fact that here Reinhold was the CEO of Jaguar, which was an extremely small company, that the fact that that various banks suspected there were bad loans on Jaguar's accounts, the fact that he was the CEO of such a small company, it's reasonable to infer from that he either was directly involved in the business that Jaguar was conducting, or at least had knowledge of the business Jaguar was conducting. And therefore, it made it more probable that he was associated with Jaguar as the enterprise, and has also knowingly conducted or participated directly or indirectly in that enterprise through a pattern of racketeering.
And even if the information had some remote relevance to knowledge, what he knew, at what time he knew it, why wouldn't this information just be so prejudicial to the defendant that any potential relevance was substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice?
Well, I think as was discussed just prior, this evidence was, although it made it more probable that he was involved in the COCA violations, the evidence was, as Judge Jones had pointed out before, it was nonspecific in general. It was evidence that there were suspicious loans, but there was no evidence other than suspicion. So I don't think that there was a whole lot of unfair prejudicial value to this evidence.
Why shouldn't we say that this was just overreaching by the prosecutor? I mean, if he had evidence of the 16 transactions, why not limit the introduction of evidence to that as opposed to trying to prejudice Mr. Reinhold with mere suspicions?
Well, I think the other part of it is that in a case such as this, where there are, especially in a COCA case, where there are complicated transactions going on, there may be a business that jurors don't understand. It's important for the jury to understand the type of business that Jaguar was, the type of business that they were conducting, who they were conducting that business with, how the investigation began, and how the investigation came to be. And I think that evidence helped paint that picture for the jury. And again, I think there was no unfair prejudice to this evidence. It was just very nonspecific in general, and I don't think that the probative value could have been substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice in this case.
It seems it would have been more relevant if it would have been more specific, though. I mean, it doesn't seem to me that much different from saying, from a witness saying, this was a really shady business. I mean, how it seems to me, in your view, that'd be admissible.
Well, I think in this case, especially, it was mitigated by the fact that there, it was clear that many of Jaguar's loans were performing as promised. And it was also, I think, clear from the testimony that Jaguar had been a legitimate business. So, you know, the testimony that 41 out of 90 loans were suspicious still leaves more than half of those loans on the Colorado State Bank and Trust accounts performing as promised. And I, again, I don't think indicating...
Well, Mr. Zweig, if that's true, if it's this evidence apparently was useful to show that Jaguar was a legitimate business to some extent, why would the prosecutor want to introduce that evidence?
Again, I think it was. I think the purpose of the evidence was to show the jury, put in context the business that Jaguar was conducting, and to explain the jury essentially how these COCA violations and underlying predicates came to be. I think without the understanding of the type of business that Jaguar was and the business they were conducting, the jury may have been a little lost in a complicated case such as this. And so to provide that background, I think, was important for the jury.
Did the trial court conduct a 403 analysis of this evidence?
I don't recall if there was an explicit 403 analysis here. I think I think the response to the objection was that, given the nature of the charges here, nature of the COCA charges here, this evidence is admissible. But again, I think that there was just not much unfair prejudicial value to this evidence, and therefore I don't think that it could have substantially outweighed the probative value of the evidence.
Thank you.
Did evidence come into trial as to the total number of loans handled by Jaguar over a particular period of time?
I think there was testimony from the various bank representatives about estimates of how many loans were on the accounts, but I don't recall a specific number saying that Jaguar had 1,500 loans on various lines of credit. I think CSBT came in and said, we looked at 91 loans. I think Citywide might have said they had looked at 30 loans or so, 30 or 40 loans or so, but I don't recall an aggregate number that was presented.
Well, I guess then the problem is, without that larger number, how could the jury get this inference that you're talking about, that there was this legitimate business and this is just a small percentage of the loans involved, if the only evidence that's presented is about the suspicious loans? Isn't the inference for the jury that this company is just entirely not on the up and up?
Well, I think CSBT testified that, again, that they had 41 out of 90 raised some red flags for them, so I think that indicates that there were definitely legitimate loans on that account. And there was during that testimony, I believe, there was also just testimony that they had been doing business with Jaguar for an extended period of time at that point before these red flags began to pop up. So I think that indicated that there was legitimate business being conducted. Any more questions regarding the evidentiary issues? I'd like to move on to the COCA statute. The language of subsection 4 of the COCA statute indicates that endeavor is not meant to be interpreted as the crime of attempted COCA. If endeavor was interpreted as such, one half of that subsection would end up being a lesser included, while the other half remained a separate substantive crime. And I don't think that, given the way that subsection is written, the legislature could have intended that.
Mr. Zweig, in order to accept your argument on that point, do we have to decline to follow the New Crawford Valley case from this court?
Sure. I don't think you have to decline to follow it, because I don't think the analysis in that case is relevant to the case here. The holding in New Crawford Valley is not that a criminal conviction under subsection 4 must merge with conviction under any of those other subsections. The analysis in that case concerns whether a civil claim for relief under subsections 1, 2, or 3 is sufficient to state a claim for relief under subsection 4. And so, given the nature of that case, I don't think that analysis of criminals, there was any analysis of criminal attempt or double jeopardy or merger in that case, and therefore I don't think the analysis in that case applies. I think it's also important to note that the word attempt was not used in the subsection. That given that the attempt statute existed, and there are various other places that the legislature has used the word attempt outside of the statutory attempt, and they just didn't use that word here. They also even used the word attempt in the definition for racketeering activity. So I think you have to presume.
Mr. Dwag, in your view, what does endeavor mean here if it doesn't mean attempt?
Well,
it doesn't mean criminal attempt.
Sure. I think a person commits a criminal attempt if acting with the culpability required for the commission of an offense, he engages in conduct constituting a substantial step towards the commission of the offense. I think what makes the most sense, to me at least, is that endeavor is something different than attempt, in that attempt deals with conduct that involves one crime, and endeavoring involves a course of conduct that promotes multiple crimes, which constitute a pattern of racketeering.
Counsel, but how do we know whether the jury understood endeavoring to mean attempt? I mean, somebody could say, I'm endeavoring to do X, I'm attempting, I'm taking substantial steps towards that.
Well, I think in this case, the jury wasn't instructed on criminal attempt. So I don't think they can be expected to know what the standard for criminal attempt here. I think the definition for endeavor that they gave was an earnest attempt. And I think that was probably taken from the definition of attempt, which is, I think, outside of what statutory attempt means. So I don't think there could have been a finding of attempt here by the jury, or criminal attempt, at least, by the jury here.
Well, it sounds to me like you're making a quantitative distinction. You say attempt relates to a single crime, endeavor relates to multiple crimes, but it seems like all you're saying there is that endeavor is attempting to commit multiple crimes.
I think what I'm trying to say is that endeavor is the conduct that sort of connects the multiple crimes that constitute a pattern of racketeering here. I'm not trying to say that endeavoring is just attempting to commit multiple crimes. I think I'm saying, what I'm trying to say is that the scope of the activity that connects the pattern of racketeering is the endeavoring to commit the COCA.
And which sounds an awful lot like attempt.
Right. I mean, why would the legislature want convictions for both multiple violations of COCA and endeavoring to commit multiple violations of COCA the way you've described it?
I'm sorry.
I mean, why would the legislature want a conviction to stand for both crimes, for both the endeavoring offense and the commission of the COCA offense?
You know, I think that, I mean, it's clear, I think it's undisputed here that conspiring to commit COCA is a separate substantive offense. And I think it may have been just a way to be as broad as possible and being able to capture that behavior that leads to the pattern of racketeering.
So in that scenario, endeavor is synonymous with conspire?
I don't know if I would use the word synonymous, but I think that it is falls into the same category as being a separate crime, the same as conspiring to violate COCA does.
Well, the gist of a conspiracy and the reason it's punished is the agreement to commit the crime. It's not the commission of the crime, it's the agreement to commit the crime. And we've distinguished conspiracy from attempt because attempt doesn't share that feature. It is the actual trying to commit a crime. And don't we have to construe the words that the legislature uses in accordance with their plain and ordinary meanings? And if we do, how can we get around endeavor being simply trying to commit the crime?
I think in this case, you can get around that because attempt has a specific meaning as far as criminal attempt goes. It does not have the dictionary definition meaning of attempt. And therefore, because that word wasn't used in this statute, you have to assume that they did, that the legislature did not mean for that, for to endeavor to include the crime of criminal attempt. It meant it to be something different than attempt.
So if attempted, if an attempt crime, if an attempt crime was given here and the definition of criminal attempt was given to the jury, and the jury convicted him of attempt to commit a COCA violation, you think that that conviction could stand alongside the conviction for endeavoring to commit a COCA violation? They both could stand because they're different crimes?
I'm sorry, is the question if you're convicted of attempted COCA and endeavoring?
Yeah, hypothetically, could both an attempted COCA violation under your view of criminal attempt exist alongside an endeavoring to commit the COCA violation? They both could stand as separate crimes?
Yes. Just as, I think just as you could have a conspiring, yes, my answer would be yes.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I'd respectfully ask that this court affirm the trial court's judgments and sentences. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Evans, I think you have about 4.5 minutes left.
May it please the court, if this court has questions about the endeavoring issue, I'm happy to discuss that. However, I think that my response to the Attorney General is well explained in the reply brief, and I would prefer to focus on the conviction itself.
Well, on that first issue, the endeavoring issue, we don't have any way of knowing whether the jury convicted your client of endeavoring, do we? And how can we reverse based on speculating as to what it might have done?
Because, Your Honor, on the basis of Francis B. Franklin and Lowe, both of which are cited in the opening and the reply, if you're in exactly that situation where the jury could have either reached a valid verdict on conspiring or an invalid verdict on endeavoring defined as attempt, you have to assume that it was the invalid verdict.
You're relying on People versus Lowe for that proposition?
Lowe and Francis B. Franklin, Your Honor.
Francis B. Franklin?
That's correct. Both of which are cited in the briefs.
All right, but the Dunaway case seems to have disapproved of the rationale used in the Lowe case. They expressly disapproved of the rationale in James, which was based on the rationale in Lowe.
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I did not review Dunaway before this argument. If the court would like supplemental briefing on the impact of that case, I would be happy to provide it. However, again, given the limited amount of time that I have here, I would prefer to focus on the conviction itself. Judge Navarro, you asked if the district court conducted a CRE 403 analysis. The answer is no. Judge Jones, you asked whether evidence came in regarding the number of the loans the Jaguar was handling. The answer to that is yes. The record site is January 12th, 2011 at page 53, and it does indicate that there were a sizable number of loans. But with all due respect, contrary to what you were saying, I think that that's what makes the evidence all the more damaging. And the evidence here was that Jaguar was handling a large number of loans, and the state came up with a very small number to charge him with, and he came to court with an explanation for why he was not at fault for those loans. And under those circumstances, saying, no, actually, it was four times that, which amounts to more like, you know, 10% of your total business here, that was bad. I think
Mr. Evans, my understanding from your brief as well as the record is the defendant's theory of the case was that while it's true that all of these bad activities happened at Jaguar, he did not commit them. Others did them, principally Ms. Hawker. And so he admitted that Jaguar was associated with many suspicious loans. He just said he did not commit them. Others did. So how is this general evidence that all these bad things might have happened at Jaguar any different from defendant's theory of the case? It seems to be entirely consistent with defendant's theory of the case.
Because, Your Honor, for the charged offenses, he came to court ready to explain that there was evidence showing that he wasn't at fault. I mean, you know, anytime someone is on trial, there is an inherent suspicion in them. I mean, the state has obviously charged him with committing these offenses.
Right, but he has admitted that this Jaguar engaged in many suspicious activities, just that somebody else was responsible, not him. And you've already admitted that this other evidence did not specifically name him or was not connected to him in any way. So isn't that just his theory of defense?
No, Your Honor, because without, you know, what the state also tried to show was that he, as the head of this company, should have been aware that all of this was going on. And that's, you know, where the prejudice comes in here, that, you know, this non-specific information that the real problem is so much bigger was devastating faced with that, you know, those questions at trial. See that I'm out of time. Does the court have any additional questions for me? I respectfully ask that this court reverse Mr. Reinhold's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today. We will issue an opinion in due course in this case.